Blog Talk Radio.
You got to listen to the Bob Carson Show. It's about the real deal. And this is Les Leopold, the author of Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice.
Hi, this is Stuart Acuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
I'm Andrew Craig. I'm an investigative reporter and attorney based in Washington, and I'm the author of Presidential Puppetry, Obama, Romney, and Their Masters. And I want to encourage everyone to support, listen to, and talk about the Carson's Corner show in New Jersey, which is a pioneering, courageous, and apt voice for progressives in New Jersey that I first came to know in 2009, when he was the pioneering and virtually unique media outlet willing to take on Chris Christie, dig deep, and look at how he had come to power and how he was misusing it. And 4 years, 5 years later here, that's all come to pass.
Hi, this is David K. Johnston, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
Hi, this is Harry Kaysen, member supporter of the Zeitgeist Movement. As Zeitgeist members, we know that it is virtually impossible to find sources in the media that speak truth to power. Well, Carson's Corner does just that, and it is one of those special places where you can find out what is really going on. Not just what the bosses want you to know and think. So listen in and hear some truth at Carson's Corner. And oh, by the way, be sure to check out all the Zeitgeist and Zeitgeist-related films you can find on YouTube. We've got a world to save.
This is Greg Palin, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book, Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. And you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio. Radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Hey, this is Frank Schaefer, author, writer, New York Times bestseller. But I'm here today because I've got a new book called Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. And I'm also on Carson's Corner because corporate media is so one-dimensional in terms of the kind of things they cover that they couldn't comprehend a discussion that would begin with a statement that implies a huge paradox. But I think there's a lot of thinking people out there who understand that life is paradoxical, and Carson's Corner is one of those places you can discuss it. So thanks for being with us.
Listeners, and welcome to Carson's Corner. Tonight's episode is themed Russia and China and COVID-19. Oh my! and those are the three boogeymen of the Trump apocalypse. Boogeymen because no threat is coming from Russia. The only threat involved is U.S. threat against Russia. No threat is coming from China. The only threat is the threat of U.S. imperialism. And COVID-19, which is a real threat, but which the Trump regime has botched so badly in its official handling that many, many more people have lost their lives due to Trump's buffoonish ineptitude. Anyway, tonight's theme will, I think you'll see almost in every topic we deal with in one way or another. And we are joined tonight by Rainer Shea, the brilliant young journalist, Marxist journalist, Marxist-Leninist journalist, whose prolific work continues to illuminate. Rainer, I think we've got a couple of, or at least one, article by you tonight to discuss here on Carson's Corner.
Good.
So, Rainer, how you doing?
I'm almost done with the semester, and I'm continuing to settle into this routine. I mean, I'm in this the situation right now where I'm in a pretty okay state in my home life. I feel like my family is stable financially for the moment, but I've been talking with other working class people I know, and I've been talking with people who've lost their jobs, and in these last 2 months, so many people have been experiencing gigantic losses.
Yes.
Sinking deeper into debt, and so many people aren't getting government benefits. Even in the liberal state of California, the government isn't doing its job to protect the general welfare, and something like 40 million people, or 25% of the adult population, is unemployed right now. It doesn't matter when the government tries to restart the economy. The economy is doomed. It was doomed a long time ago.
Yeah, the performance by Gavin Newsom is something to behold, and I say that in the most negative sense. Newsom is I recall a friend of mine ran against Newsom for his name is Matt. He ran against Newsom for mayor, and he was on the Green Party ticket when Newsom first ran as mayor of San Francisco. And Matt, believe it or not, came within 2% of a victory there, but for that 2%, history might have changed quite a bit to have a green mayor of San Francisco instead of a Democrat mayor of San Francisco, now governor of California. And he's a typical liberal capitalist imperialist Democrat. That's what you get when you vote for liberals. You get people like Newsom fucking things up. Capitalism fucks things up. What can we say? Yeah, and he's certainly not the worst of them when it comes to governors. There are a lot of them that are even worse out there. Anyway, it sounds like, Rainer, like things are stable where you're at. Glad to hear that you're term is almost over for the what do they call that, the spring term? It's almost
semester,
over.
Yeah,
spring semester. That's progress. You'll just have to keep on going. You know, got to get that sheepskin in America, pretty much, even to have a lower middle class life or an upper working class life, you need that sheepskin. And that's the most that 90% of people who go to college could ever hope for. You know, but it's always a lot worse. I mean, your job choices are far worse if you don't have that. I went to college very late in life. I mean, I was in my late 30s when I started university, trying to learn journalism and get out of being an electronics technician, which is what I had been for, I don't know, 20-some-odd years prior to that. And I got to say, my life definitely improved in many ways. Certainly the job quality improved. I mean, being a journalist isn't all that one would hope for, but it's you know, definitely a step up from being an electronics technician in electronic factories, which are, in America, electronics factories are deadly. I don't know if you've ever studied this issue, but electronic factories are just filled with chemical threats to the life, all kinds of threats to the life. So your health is in peril the whole time you're trapped in one of those electronics factories in the United States, most of which have been closed down now. You know, electronics, I mean, there's still an electronics industry in the United States, still a few huge electronics companies. You've got your Motorola's and, you know, your GE's and so forth that still do some production, but a whole hell of a lot of the production that was up and going when I was a young man is now been moved to the Far East, to China, Vietnam, you know, Japan to a lesser extent, although Japan's going through, has been going through the same thing we have of farming out all of its scut work. Anyway, tonight's first topic, Rainer, is Michael Flynn in the Russiagate hoax. Now, over the last couple of weeks, and we've reported on this already in previous shows, but a whole slew of information has come out proving that there was a vast criminal conspiracy aimed at entrapping Michael Flynn, who at that time was the national security advisor to the president. Very powerful position, probably you could say in the way of the espionage community, it's the most powerful position one can have. And Flynn, early on, got a lot of the ruling class people pissed off because in 2012 he pointed out that U.S. policies under President Barack Obama were deliberately fostering a new terrorist group growing and growing into a caliphate. That was ISIS. And then under Trump and Trump's first year in office, Michael Flynn was advising Trump that the Russiagate hoax was a hoax, that there was no substance to it. Since that time, we've seen that the Russiagate hoax, the Russiagate claims by the liberals and neocons, that hoax has basically fallen apart. People don't believe it anymore, especially after the report by Robert Mueller former FBI director who did a long, exhaustive, a tremendously expensive independent investigation of all of the Russiagate claims and found very little. I mean, he found that there was no collusion between the president and Russia, number one. He put forward some tepid claims that were really lies about Russia, about the Russian government being somehow involved in meddling in the 2016 U.S. federal elections, which basically is, it's all fallen apart since then. So now, with these revelations, I think the best of those revelations was a letter written by the point man, the head of, in, within the FBI of the investigation to Michael Flynn, where he asks the question of all the other FBI criminals who were involved in this vast criminal conspiracy, are we out to find the truth, or are we out to trap Flynn into a lie so that we can either get him fired or put him in jail, so forth and so on? I mean, it was obviously entrapment, obviously a criminal conspiracy for entrapment. Two of the lead senior FBI agents, Strzok and Lisa, what the hell's her name, two man and a woman, male-female FBI agents were obviously, from all of their letters to one another, emails to one another, which actually were exposed a few years back, they were obviously Democrats, dyed-in-the-wool liberal Democrats who were out to get Michael Flynn. Evidence has mounted that President Barack Obama was nose deep in this criminal conspiracy, in directing this criminal conspiracy. And even after he was out of office, he was still directing FBI agents in this deliberate hoax, this deliberate Russiagate hoax, and in this deliberate attempt to get Michael Flynn, the guy. I mean, there, you know, there's a lot of bad things you can say about Michael Flynn. He was, after all, in the espionage part of the military for a long time. He's not a good guy. But for some reason, you know, he fit what Trump was peddling back in those days. Trump has long since forgotten all that, but he fit what Trump was peddling, and Trump tapped him to be the national security advisor. And he came out with the truth that Russiagate was a hoax. That's why they wanted to get rid of him. Not only that, but of course, but the fact that Flynn exposed the fact that the Obama regime was deliberately supporting, funding, training, and arming terrorists, Islamic terrorists, if you want to call it that, or jihadi terrorists, in an attempt to use those terrorists against the legitimate president of Syria and against the Syrian people. You know, that regime change was what they were really after. And Michael Flynn stood in the way of all that because he was a truth teller. At least on those two issues, he was a truth teller. So, you know, this story is really ripening like a great juicy fruit. The whole Obama criminal conspiracy has been exposed now. Hopefully there will be prosecutions in the future, although I'm dubious about whether Trump, probably the weakest president in modern history, has the energy or the wherewithal to actually follow through with actual prosecutions of the real criminals who were FBI agents and Barack Obama himself. Rainer, your thoughts?
I kind of stopped paying attention to the Russiagate situation since the Russiagate was definitively proven wrong in the mainstream with the release of the Mueller report. But
right.
this definitely, what you said definitely reflects on what I remember learning about with the Obama administration, the Obama intelligence agencies having coordinated these ploys to manipulate the 2016 election and to create a narrative about Russian interference that was ultimately utilized for years by the majority of the corporate media. I mean, the Russiagate continued well into 2019, and it was all part of this effort to deflect from the blame for Clinton's loss and to escalate the Cold War with Russia. So I'm glad these details are coming out. I mean, it's entirely predictable, but I'm glad this is documented.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Let's see here. We have a couple of callers on the line tonight. Let's check that out. I don't know. I've never quite figured this out. There's a little question mark by their names. I'm not sure if that means that they're waiting to be called on or not to be called on. Let's try this 541 number and see. Hello, 541 caller. How are you?
Why don't you admit you're gay?
Pardon me?
You are gay.
Well, no, I'm not, sir, but there would certainly be nothing wrong with it if I were. What an idiot. Okay, so that was a harassment call. Let's see this other caller and see if he's any... Hello, 205 caller. You're on the line. How are you?
Hey, I got my cock stuck in a belt sander. It fucking hurts.
I'm sorry. We couldn't really understand that. These people that are calling, looks like there's some kind of a coordinated attack. Denial of services attack, maybe you'd call it, if this was in the computer realm, but they're not really able to deny our services. Anyway, that guy just came on and said something that was barely audible, but not sure. But I'm pretty
sure.
The
only thing I heard was the F word.
Yeah. Right. Fucking. We're allowed to say fucking on on Blog Talk Radio. It's not over the air. FCC doesn't regulate this. I've got to watch out for myself because I really cuss a lot, and I'm also a ham radio operator, and it is illegal for me to use all those cuss words when I'm on the radio. On the ham radio, that's a verboten no-no. The FCC might come out and give me a fine for that. So I have to really discipline myself. Maybe I should do that here too. I don't know. Maybe a lot of people don't like that kind of language. To me, it's like second nature. You know, I came up in the working class and as a journalist. When I was a young journalist, first getting into journalism, I worked at the Arizona Republic, and my editor, I swear, like every third word out of his mouth was fucking this, fucking that. He was a real character. I wonder if he's still around working, although he was probably 10 years older than me, so I doubt it. In any case, onward and upward. Topic number two, in the people's war against COVID-19, socialism offers victory while capitalism spells defeat. Now, this is something that, you know, it's an issue that we've dealt with on a few occasions already. The idea that capitalism has made a botched job out of dealing with COVID-19, while socialism has been quite the opposite. And this article, along the same vein, comes from someone who I highly appreciate, someone who's been on our show several times. His name is Danny Haifong. He writes for the Black Agenda Report. Danny, in his article, is published in the blackagendareport.com, The People's War Against COVID-19, Socialism Offers Victory While Capitalism Spells Defeat. He did a great job. This is from May 6th, 2020, so last week. Danny says socialist societies are capable of doing much more to contain diseases like COVID-19, such as rapid testing, neighborhood food deliveries, the use of AI technology to trace contacts and symptoms. These are all services which the Chinese state provided, the Cuban state provided to its citizens, the Vietnamese state provided to its citizens, I believe the North Korean state also. And what's the commonality there? The commonality is that those are socialist workers' states. Now, what does that mean? It means that the working class is the ruling class in those countries. The working class is in the driver's seat through its communist parties. The working class. And have no doubt that communist parties have always been working class parties and still are today. In the case of China, for instance, it's more of an alliance between the working class and the peasantry. And to me, peasants are just another kind of working class people. So. Not too far divergent there. In any case, Danny does a great job here. I just wanted to recommend this article. He goes over some of the experiences, like in the United States, for instance, which has made no progress at all, basically. Danny talks about here in recent weeks, white supremacist and libertarian forces representing the most impassioned stewards of imperial decline have gathered in states across the country to protest partial lockdown orders. He talks about that for a while. These capitalist countries have these idiots. This is the only word I can think of to describe them coming out. And I saw a beautiful thing today. One of those big rallies that these right-wing tools, these right-wing middle-class assholes, went to protest the lockdown. I think it was in Michigan. And, like, more than 60 of them ended up coming down with COVID-19. So talk about Darwin's revenge. these are all great. Those are all great candidates for the yearly Darwin Award that's given out by the stupid to the stupidest idiot who does some clownish thing that ends up killing him or herself, or in any in some other way harming him or herself. Darwin's revenge. And then Danny goes over something we've gone over before on this show, China's successful response to the virus. He also talks about Vietnam's successful response, Cuba's successful response, it's actually a great article. I just wanted to recommend it to people. Go to blackagendareport.com and look for In the People's War Against COVID-19, Socialism Offers Victory While Capitalism Spells Defeat. Rainer, thoughts?
Oh yeah, I've been amusing myself with those protests against the lockdown. I recently saw a photo where three suburban white guys had been playing out the Passion of the Christ, dressing like Jesus Christ, and hanging themselves on a cross to protest their supposed oppression, and they were doing it in front of a McDonald's, and there was a grill in the background. And so that's America in 2020. So yeah, returning to the larger point of this article, it's really incredible how these nations, China, DPRK, Vietnam, and Cuba, I don't know about Laos, but I assume they're doing well too. It's amazing how these nations have responded to this. It's amazing how the DPRK, despite being ridiculed by the capitalists the world over for their being isolated or being backwards, they're the country that's not encountered any COVID-19 cases, as far as I know, and all of these nations have been utilizing their impressive social safety nets to maintain the public welfare amid this crisis, and to bring down the pandemic as fast as we can reasonably expect from them, and it really reflects a trend that's going to get more dramatic throughout this century, which is the trend of socialism creating collective survival while capitalism creating selective survival.
Okay. That's a Rainer Shea quote that's worthy of of Jesse Jackson, I'd say, in its alliterative rhyme and reason. Very well said. Topic number three, let's move on. The third world struggle against imperialism is crucial, according to Rainer Shea. And I wonder if Rainer can tell us more.
Oh, yes. In this article, I point out the basic reality of the state of revolutionary politics in the United States and in the other imperialist countries, which is that workers in the imperial core in the United States, because of their degree of complicity in the exploitation of the Third World and the Global South, they tend to become tethered to the interests of the capitalist class. The white working class in America has long been largely in lockstep, or at least has had a sense of solidarity with the capitalist class because of colonialism and because of white supremacy. And this is continuing even as conditions for the working class here rapidly deteriorate. So until material conditions change and until the left and the communist movement here can build a larger organizational structure and convince more people to give up this colonial chauvinism and this false class interest with the capitalist class, hope for revolution in the imperial core isn't going to be very substantial. But it's a different story in the third world, in countries like Brazil and Chile and Argentina. In Latin America in particular, the left is very well organized. They're vastly more well organized than is the case in the United States, and even though Chile and Brazil and many other countries are controlled by neoliberal U.S. backed regimes, the protest movements have been emerging in the last year within these countries because of how well prepared the left in these countries is. So what I'm hoping for is a new wave of revolutions throughout the third world, throughout Latin America, and hopefully Africa and Asia too. South Africa is another place to watch in the coming years. So if the third world can have this new wave of revolutions, the interests of the American capitalist class are going to be hurt. They're going to have to contract their operations because neocolonialism and the extraction of labor and resources from these countries is how global capitalism as it now exists can function. What the capitalists are afraid of is a new wave of revolutions in the third world in particular, and that's why they've been acting so desperate to retake Venezuela with this recent coup attempt there. So if this new wave of revolutions comes in the third world, it's going to get easier for the revolutionary movement in the first world to succeed.
Okay. Sorry it took me so long to get back to the phone. I agree 100%. I think there's a crucial element here, and that is for a long time in the revolutionary socialist movement or communist movement, whatever you want to call it, the real socialist movement, let's call it that, in the United States, of which I've been I've been involved since I was a very young man, I guess since I was about 18 years old. The idea that in the metropolitan centers of imperialism, such as the United States being the primary one, but others exist as well in Europe and in Japan, for instance, and Australia and New Zealand, outposts, Anglo settler states, outposts, in other parts of the world. The concept has been very strong, a big tradition that was there long before I became involved. of support for struggling oppressed nations around the world, support of their national liberation struggles. These countries, some people call it the Third World. That was a term that Mao used. In today's world, a lot of these, like a lot of the nations that you mentioned there, Rainer, like Argentina, for example, are really highly developed countries. They're not really third world countries at all. What is unique about them is not so much their third world status, but their status as neo-colonies of the American Empire. In fact, to one extent or another, with a few exceptions, almost every country in Latin America has been turned over the last 150 years by the American Empire into neo-colonies. That's a term that's used to differentiate these kind of colonies from the traditional colony in which the governmental administration, the state administration, was directly controlled by the imperialists, by the United States, by the American Empire. But a country like Argentina, as an example, has long been oppressed. There were times when they struggled to get out of it, like right after World War II and during World War II, when their imperial overlords were busy with World War II. They used that chance to try to put a lot of separation between them and the United States economically and politically. Mexico did the same thing at that time. What you would call the developed, as opposed to the underdeveloped parts of Latin America. Brazil, another example of a country that's mostly been under the thumb of U.S. imperialism, although Brazil had like about 20 years or so up until the last few years where the Workers' Party was in control. And so there was at least some working class socialist struggle for liberation and struggle against U.S. imperialism. But, for those of us who are revolutionary socialists in the United States of America should be that we do everything in our power during this time when we know that the conditions are not necessarily ripe for revolution in our own country. We continue, of course, to work towards that, to organize towards that, to educate towards that. But along with that, we understand that national liberation struggles in that part of the world that is under the thumb of U.S. imperialism, under the thumb of the American Empire. We should be doing, and I have in my life, been doing everything that I could to lend those working classes and those oppressed third world countries or oppressed first world countries, for that matter, countries like Mexico and Argentina and Brazil, which are highly, they're in the, all three of those are in the G20. They're highly developed countries, but they're still oppressed because Latin America has been oppressed by the United States for a long time. And that explains a lot of why the left is so much stronger in Latin America than in here in the metropolitan center of imperialism. It explains so much about why those countries have traditionally, for quite a long time, had liberation struggles of one kind or another, and they continue to do so. So it's our, it should be our goal to do everything we can to lend aid and comfort, to lend our solidarity to these working class liberation struggles. The primary threat to humanity is U.S. imperialism, and anything that we can do to undermine U.S. imperialism, to bring it to an end, we should do. That should be part of our lifelong task. So, well said, Rainer. Well done article. Just got the chance to read it today. Anything else to add?
Oh, well, the reason why I classify a country like Argentina as third world is because I've been personally talking with a comrade from Argentina, and the way he's described Argentina when he's described it as third world is that, well, places like Argentina have a significant more amount of poverty than in the United States. Slums are a lot more normal there, and there are, of course, sections of Argentina that aren't third world, like the wealthy sections, but as is the case for places like the United States, there are sections of that society that can be considered third world. I mean, I want to think of the third world in terms the differentiation between the first world and the third world in terms of countries and borders. The borders don't separate the first world and the third world, or the fourth world for that matter. What separates these worlds are national lines, and nations are different from countries. Really, different nations represent different communities that can exist within the same borders, and there are a lot of parts, even in the United States, that can be considered third world. And
I do consider them third world.
Yeah,
a lot of places I travel through they're so reminiscent of a highly underdeveloped country, and it's getting worse. I mean, you look at the infrastructure in the United States; it's crumbling like a third world country. huge pockets of extreme poverty, and there always has been huge pockets of extreme poverty. It got better during the 50s and 60s, especially in the late 60s, but quickly all that had been gained through the American labor movement at that time were rolled back in the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2010s. To where today, you know, you can find these pockets of extreme poverty almost everywhere, these pockets of extreme underdevelopment. And, of course, yes, Argentina is the same way and has always been. That's a sad commentary on life under capitalism, under capitalist imperialism. So, let's see, where are we at? I think we're on topic four, the plot to blame COVID-19 on China has a long history. Now, I'm relying on a couple of articles that I read just recently in the last few days to inform this topic. But first of all, the idea of the idea that COVID-19 is being blamed on China has a long history is best explained, I think, in a great article by T.J. Coles. I don't agree with everything T.J. Coles says in this article, but the plot to blame China for COVID-19, Coles goes over the whole history and shows how this plot has been around a lot longer than just since COVID-19. COVID-19 is fits into an already existing narrative, an already existing war on China that was started, you know, really in the 19—the United States has had great hostility towards China since 1949, and the United States did a lot of extraordinary criminal things against China in the Civil War leading up to the great liberation of 1949, in cahoots with the Chinese Nationalist Party, the Kuomintang, against the Communist Party. But the Communist Party was victorious, and that got the Americans hopping mad. Matter of fact, I knew a guy long, long time ago, Fred Halstead, who was in the Army in 1946, stationed, he was in the American Army in 1946, stationed in China. And the United States was moving troops, because it had so many troops in that area that it had been using against Japan. And then after Japan was defeated, they started moving these troops into China to get involved in and give support to the Kuomintang against the Communist Party to try to stop the Chinese Revolution there. Fred Halstead and a whole slew, I mean, hundreds of thousands of his comrades in the U.S. military held vast protests. Now, I mean, they were in the military, so protesting when you're in the military is pretty dangerous as it is, you know. But when there, you know, there's power in numbers, and there were so many people involved in this protest, demanding that they be brought home, that they not be kept there to get involved in another silly foreign war. And finally, they were successful in making it impossible for Truman, the criminal, the mass-murdering criminal who dropped the atomic bomb on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, to keep these forces in China. He was forced to withdraw them. So even back then, the United States has been plotting against China. In the 1980s, when Deng Xiaoping became the leader of China and brought about new economic policy style reforms, Leninist reforms in China, to start making use of market mechanisms, to start making use of some small-scale private enterprise for the purpose of strengthening socialism, and that's what they've been doing ever since, and it's been working great. But starting especially in 2011, Barack Obama started his pivot to Asia, and the pivot to Asia was an attempt basically to move 60% of U.S. war-making capacities into the Pacific region, South Pacific, Western Pacific, and region of China as a threat against China. And this war has been getting worse and worse ever since. So we know all the history there. This article really goes into the history behind how the Trump regime has been using COVID-19 as a battering ram against, propaganda battering ram against China. He goes into the what are called the Rogan cables that come from this guy who's a writer for the Washington Post, Rogan, who has published a number of deceitful lies against China, trying to direct attention towards the Wuhan Institute for Virology, and trying to prove that the COVID-19 virus escaped in an accident at that lab, at that laboratory, which, of course, this guy's name is Josh Rogan, well-known security talking head on channels like MSNBC and CNN. Anyway, it goes into all that, how the Trump regime has been using this as a battering ram against China. And this is just, it's incredible. This article's in counterpunch.org. You can get it. The plot to blame China for COVID-19 was published on May 8th. Also, there's another article by Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flowers that calls on Americans to protest for peace with China, what they call it, a pivot towards peace. So, Rainer?
Yeah, I've been, if you've seen the Media Roots podcast that discusses the media campaign to scapegoat China for COVID-19, you'll also know that the Trump administration has officially been coordinating, but it's officially decided to use China as a something to blame for the virus, and this has resulted in them coordinating it's pretty obvious that they're coordinating efforts within the right wing media to promote misinformation that used to blame China, like Tucker Carlson. He's helped spearhead this campaign. So much of the messages he's been putting out lately have been this repeated hammering in of the idea that China is to blame, and Tucker Carlson and the rest of Fox News have been using Trump-like catchphrases to associate China with COVID-19. So there's this whole campaign coming from the highest levels of government right now to carry out this campaign to scapegoat a geopolitical adversary. And the problem, though, is that it's extremely easy for their lies to be exposed and picked apart. And I say this because there was a recent CNN article that I don't remember the headline, but it was a CNN article that described how the White House's COVID-19 line on China had fallen apart. And it's extremely obvious that it's not true that this virus escaped from a Wuhan laboratory, as they've been saying. So they're if they can't prove that it came from a Wuhan laboratory, they're going to keep claiming that China mismanaged the virus, or that they were negligent or incompetent. And sadly, this line is reflected across the whole mainstream political spectrum, Republican and Democrat alike. Bernie Sanders is included in this.
Yes, definitely. Sanders is one of those who's always had a big heart on for war with China. One of his favorite countries to blame for everything that's wrong with the United States. Tucker Carlson, too. Tucker is pretty good on some issues, but on this one he is, all the way pro-imperialist, all the way pro-Trump regime in this plot to blame COVID-19 on China, plot to get the United States into a war with China. The hybrid asymmetrical war that the United States has been carrying on intensively since Barack Obama's pivot to Asia in 2011 is really climbing to a crescendo here. We have in the last month, there's been a tremendous amount more naval activity in the South China Sea aimed at provoking China into an incident, Air Force provocations as well. This push towards war, it's really quite insane if you think about it. I mean, China is a nuclear armed state. It's like a game of chicken. When I was a kid, I mean, I never did this, but when I was a kid, teenagers would play chicken, which meant you'd get into two cars facing one another, maybe, 500 or 600 feet from one another, and you'd start those cars up and start heading right towards one another and see which one chickened out at the last moment and swerved out of the way, which is an insane thing to do. I used to think it was an insane thing to do. I thought, why would these idiots, really taught me that a lot of teenagers don't think straight. But in any case, that's what this is. I mean, this is, Trump is deliberately driving the engine of war directly at China and hoping that China will swerve out of the way. It's insane because all it takes is a small little accident and everything goes up in smoke. So anything more on this one, Rainer, before we move on?
No.
Okay. Next one, Democrats and Republicans agree war against China is the answer. And this is just basically a continuation of the last topic. We're seeing this played out with the two presidential candidates. You have the incumbent, Donald Trump, the Republican, and you have Joe Biden, the groping Joe Biden, as they call him. And both of them are out there in public having a fight over who's tougher against China. You think about it. They're egging each other on. Trump claims that Biden is weak on China. Biden claims that Trump is weak on China. And, of course, neither one of them are. And their supporters in Congress, Democrat caucus in Congress and the Republican caucus in Congress, are of the same mind. They're whipping each other into a pro-war frenzy, into a pro-war hysteria. And it's reflected in the polls, unfortunately. You know, I mean, normally Americans are much more circumspect about war, but I've seen recent polls showing something like 80% of Americans support this idea of blaming China for COVID-19, despite the fact that COVID-19 actually came from U.S. laboratories, from DARPA laboratories. It's just ridiculous, and they're willing to whip each other into a hysterical frenzy to get their way over this. We've seen this in the media, playing out in the media quite a lot in the last couple of weeks, with Democrats and Republicans, leading Democrats and leading Republicans, trying to outdo them each other in their bile and hatred against the Chinese people. It really shows a despicable level of barbaric brutality, playing chicken, you know, that game I was talking about, playing chicken with the people of the world. That's basically what they're doing. Rainer?
Oh, I'm skeptical that 80%, I want to express skepticism about what exactly that poll means, what kind of question that people were answering in this poll. Like was the question do you think that China has responsibility for COVID-19 or something like that, or was it phrased in a confusing way? Because I don't know if 80% of Americans are brimming with hatred towards.
I don't know. I just looked at the poll, and that's what the poll said. It's the question was something like, do you agree that China is to blame for the COVID-19 virus? That was the question. So, I mean, this is these people are getting bombarded with propaganda. So, oh no, my phone is beeping at me again. I can't understand why this phone is running out of juice. It looks like I've run out of juice after only a small amount of time. I'm pretty sure we're not going to be able to get to any of the other topics, which is really unfortunate, but. Hold on, it looks like Nas is calling again. Let's just say hello to him before I have to leave. Hello, Nas. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing okay, man. It's a shame you guys got to cut the show short. You're giving a lot of really good information that people need. So, hey, Chris.
I know,
Rainer,
and I don't know. There's something wrong with this phone now. I can't figure out what, but it's the second week in a row that it's run out of juice on me. After an hour, a little more than an hour, so it's unfortunately I'm the one who's controlling the control board there's no like button you push to start it. You start it by calling in and putting in the host pin, and so when this phone stops going, then the show stops.
Understood.
That's pathetic.
But either way,
I'm going to investigate.
Either way, I've been listening, and you guys have done a good job, man. I just wanted to see you on the show.
It's unfortunate because we've got three more topics that are really important. American Empire officially rewrites the history of World War II. Early lockdown lifting will prolong the Greater Depression. They're calling it the Greater Depression now, which I think is appropriate. Ukrainian police hunt Jews in open act of naked fascism. So, more despicable shit that the American empire has been doing around the world and to the working class at home. So, before we go, Nas, any final thoughts from you?
I would just say it's kind of disturbing to see how they can kind of reactivate Cold War tendency within a population.
It is.
The anger against China, which was just riled up so quickly, is kind of astonishing to a degree. Even though you expected it, I didn't expect it to catch fire as quick as it did. And people are falling for it, hook, line, and sinker. So hopefully we can reverse that.
It is. I agree. That's a great note to end the show on. Rainer, as always, great job. Thank you for your wonderful participation, your stupendous contribution to the show. I'm hoping that Bob is out there listening. I'm hoping that he's feeling better these days and starting to re-energize himself and that he'll be back with us sometime soon. In the meantime, if you want more information on us, you can go to Facebook, do a search in Facebook for Election Boycott Advocates. We'll come popping up. You can join the page. Join the discussion there. And we'll be back next week. Same time. Same place. And Nas, thank you so much for calling in. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Wish we had had the chance to talk to you more. Rainer, so long until next week. Hasta la vista, everybody.